All right, welcome to the Digital Identity Podcast. I am Terry. Joining me here is Ben and Carlos from the R&D team at SelfKey. All of us are at SelfKey, so let's do some introductions. So first off, Ben, who are you and what do you do?
Hey guys, I'm Ben. I work in R&D at SelfKey, and basically we're doing work around, like, you know, digital identity, blockchain solutions, decentralization, and, you know, a few other things here and there to help along some of the projects that we have.
Nice. And how about you, Carlos?
Hey guys, I work with Ben on the research and development department. So we're in charge of all the investigations behind the platform that we're building, the whole digital identity as a general topic, and technologies that can serve our purpose, pretty much oriented towards smart contract development. That has been my role so far.
Cool. So let's start off, because we had a lot of buzzwords there. So let's start with digital identity first. What does this mean? Because I think a lot of people, when I think of myself, my name's Terry, but what does my digital identity mean? Like, how do you guys see this? Like, what's your take on this, Carlos?
I guess we can, like, introduce the more general concept of identity, which is, it's a social construct of how others perceive you as an entity, and how does a group differentiate you or an individual from the rest, right? So we're used to these concepts of identity in, let's say, the real world. In digital world, in the internet, you also need mechanisms to prove who you are or to identify entities within a group. So digital identities is quite an old concept. I would dare to say it as old as the internet itself, since there are users interacting behind all these technology. It's like this saying goes on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. You don't know who you're talking to. You don't know who are you interacting with. So there's this necessity of authentication and proof of identity. So these efforts of establishing these technologies, these platforms, has been around. They have been around for a while.
I think there's also different use cases of identity. Like, say you're playing Fortnite, you would have a game name. But if you're buying something on eBay, it would be a nickname, but it would be your real identity and a credit card behind that too, right? And so what are some other types of data that we leave online as a footprint, Ben?
There's obviously been a bit more of a push towards, like, towards privacy and being more conscious of that. But even in spite of that, like, any kind of interaction that you're doing online, you know, you're leaving something behind still, right? If you're going to go buy stuff, you know, maybe, like, it could be tracking every product that you look at, you know, and then what category it's in. It could be taking stuff like your IP address, your MAC address, you know, like user agent data, stuff like that. And then, you know, it can take all of these things and build a profile, whether or not it's, like, associated with, like, your actual name. Like, you know, you could still be technically in, like, an anonymous session or something, right? But, you know, it could still build up a profile about you as a user, you know, and what are you doing? What are you interested in? And then, like, when you get into stuff where you're registering, you know, as yourself, it could be everything, right? If any of you use a password manager, right, you could look through the list of your password manager of all the different accounts that you have and think about, like, okay, so this guy, what do they have? And now if you could put all of that data together, I mean, you'd have a really clear picture of, you know, who that person is, what they like, what they do, what they're into, what their habits are, you know, all kinds of information.
Yeah, I think even, like, a big marketing thing we do for, like, say, like, ad targeting, like, what has someone liked on Facebook, maybe on Instagram, and then that shows you what they're interested in, or even, like, browsing history, shopping habits, like, location history. I think the next level I think most people probably don't care about, like, their browsing history. Like, yeah, you see ads, but it's not as intrusive as, say, like, your medical data or, like, DNA tests, where it's, like, specifically about you.
Yeah, things that could cross over into the realm of, like physical security, right? So, like, your address or your phone number, stuff like that. Like you say, medical records. You know, there are things that, in a sense, could be weaponized kind of against you, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think they call this doxing, right, on social media, where...
Yeah, doxing.
Yeah, so if you don't know what doxing is, basically, if you're behind, like, a username on Twitter, it means someone finding out, like, your real home address, phone number, and then, like, sharing that with the world, usually because of some outrage thing. They want you to get attacked or something like that. So, like, stuff like that, you know, it's identity-based, right? Because it's who you are and who you're presenting yourself online. And, you know, sometimes we like to be anonymous, like in a video game. We're not going to use a real name with our address, right? But when it comes to, like, talking to your doctor and stuff, you need to use your...
Well, one important thing about identity is that it's always contextual. Like, it's always linked to a specific context. So it is how participants in some specific context can refer to you or interact with you. So it's like, in reality, we have, like, different identities. We sort of we're used to think of identity as like your real name and that kind of, so to speak, real world stuff. But like in your eBay profile, you have a reputation. That's part of your identity and it's granted by the community. It's not even always as how you present yourself. That might be a part, but it's how community perceives you is a crucial part of identity. There's this concept of there's no single identity. You're supposed to be able to present yourself in different manners depending on the context and disclose relevant information in each context. And that's all the ongoing work on digital identity is trying to achieve, the sort of privacy and control, give control to the user, how much they want to disclose about themselves, depending on the context, depending on who are you interacting with.
Even if you look at our space and like the cryptocurrencies, like how many fake accounts were there of like CZ at Binance and people like saying, you know, send me ETH. Also, it's identity problem too, right? Like even if he gets verified, there are people that'll get like ones that kind of look like his handle on Twitter, Instagram, and like, you know, who's to say you're the real one and he's not the fake one? That's why they have these verified tags.
Well, I got fooled the other day actually by on Twitter. There was a fake Donald Trump one, right? And you know how, well, because they use the same picture, right? And then I was on mobile and it cut off the end of the username. Like the end of their handle. So it said at real Donald Trump, but it didn't say real Donald Trump. It said at real Donald Trua or something, right? And then dot,
like
dot,
two
dot.
Two users or something like that? Yeah.
No, it was like, well, it was the dot, 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 because it was like the mobile app was cutting it off. Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? I totally fell for it because, I mean, like, you know, it was a nonsense.
Dang, that's pretty smart.
Post or whatever. Yeah. But then when you click on it and then you should see the end of the... of it, it's like real Donald Trump with like seven P's or something, right?
Yeah. So I had one similar where I followed the real CZ from Binance on Instagram and then a fake one followed me back. And then I was like, oh, CZ following. I was like, no, wait, this is not the same guy. And then it was one of those like scam, like, oh, I'll send you ETH or something like that. But it's smart though, right? Because after I followed him, you can set some monitoring thing to like follow you back. And I was like, oh, that's really smart. Because there's tools that can automate that stuff.
There's... social media automation is pretty crazy. Yeah.
Right. My second story was I was a victim of this Bitcoin password thing where they were like, remember like LinkedIn got hacked a couple years ago and then they got everyone's password. And so I got this email with my password that I used to use a lot in the subject line. It's like, oh, like, you know, by now we've kind of got your attention. You know, we've been looking at your webcam and we have all these pictures of you. Send us two Bitcoin to this address.
Oh,
and I was like, oh, okay, that's weird. I'm like, one, my camera is always covered up, it's impossible. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to mess with this guy. I'm like, so send me the private key so I can prove that you actually own this account. And like, he never replied.
Yeah.
Right? Because if I want to send it to you, how do I know I'm sending it to an address that you actually own? I'm
just
like,
exactly, right? Yeah.
And it's so interesting because the address they give you, you can add it to the Explorer, right? Like the blockchain Explorer, and just see, like, did anyone actually send anything in there? And so that's kind of interesting that you can poke around.
Did anyone there?
No, it was empty.
Really, eh?
Luckily, too. Huh. I mean, I'm sure, or maybe they just made a specific address for each person, and they kind of generated that.
Sounds like a lot of work.
Exactly. But it was interesting because when I saw the password in my email, it kind of like startled me a little bit. I was like, oh, like, I haven't seen this, like, it's kind of spooked me a little bit. So I guess it goes down to like the identity theft. Like, there's different levels, right? Like, if my Instagram gets hacked, yeah, it would suck, but it's not like life-threatening. Whereas like if my one password or last pass got hacked, that could be really devastating.
That would be real annoying. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So let's move on to talk about identity systems. So we talked about kind of what identity is, how the constructs of who we are online, and how we have like accounts at Spotify, Uber, Google, Facebook. You know, you don't own any of this, but what is the current state of, say, the traditional one? So Carlos, I know, like, what's involved in an identity transaction? I know there's three parties, right? Why don't you go over this real quick?
Well, even in the real world, since apart from the idea that identity is something that someone grants you, it's a social construct. So, for instance, a passport and a driver license, that's not your identity, but that's kind of, it is a claim, we can call it a claim, government or an institution makes regarding your persona. So it's stating that you are able to drive, for example, that you have certain age, certain name. So there's this concept of claims. Digital identity community is trying to, let's say, translate that to the digital world, making use of the cryptography to make verifiable claims. The point is that the three actors in this system would be a claim issuer, someone who makes a claim about someone, about something. There's a claim subject, which is usually the identity owner. And there's the also the relying body, which are people that make use of that information. So one brief example would be someone proving their age, that they're over 21 in a bar in order to purchase alcohol. You show your driver license, for instance. So you are the identity owner, verifying yourself, some attribute of yourself through a claim or a credential. We might call it credential. It's a bit more fitting in this context, which is the driver license. There's an issuer of that credential. There is the institution, the government. And there's a reliant body, which is the bar owner or the bar, bouncer, whoever is in charge of checking that information. So we always have these three parties interacting in the identity world. There's a credential issuer, there's an identity owner, and there's a reliant body. So more or less all the scenarios for identity consist of these three.
I think even when we think about like using your Facebook or Google account to log into another site, it's the same transaction, right? Like your Facebook is giving you the claim of your email and address, and then the relying party could be like some app that's using the OAuth, and you're the owner that's using that too.
The difference here is that there's no identity owner per se. Like speaking about self-sovereignty, there's no the user, and that's kind of the crucial aspect of all this, is that the user is not in charge, it's not in control, it's not the owner. So it's really, we all know that Facebook owns all the data. We might refer to identity subject as a subject, as a claim subject. The word owner doesn't really fit in this case because the user doesn't own anything. That's kind of what we're trying to solve with decentralized identity and self-sovereign identity. Put the control back to the actual subject, the actual owner.
Right, because right now every system of identity is pretty much siloed, right? Can you talk a little bit more about this, Ben?
Well, I mean, if you talk about the data ownership again and using these third parties for authentication, it is actually kind of interesting because it does go back a lot to using your email address. I think your email address is used extensively as part of authentication and identification online, right? But for most people, they don't even own their email address. I mean, they use like a Google service or Microsoft or Yahoo or whatever, right? Use some third party email service. You know, in a way, like a lot of times you'll have to require proof that you manage that email address, like, you know, through they'll do some kind of like two-factor, well, it's not really two-factor, but, you know, they send you an email and you have to click the link in the email, right? So, I mean, if you lose control of your email address, you could lose control of, you know, dozens of accounts that are linked to that, right? So that's actually a serious problem if you think about it. You know, if your email gets compromised and, like, you know, somebody either hacks it and changes the password, or maybe Google or Yahoo decides that you've broken their terms of service and they shut down access or something like that, right? Then all of a sudden, like, you have this like sort of cascading effect where all of these other accounts are all of a sudden inaccessible, and like you. I don't know what the language policy on this podcast is, but you are something.
Yeah, there was a journalist I read a couple of years, like 2 years ago. He was victim of a SMS switch.
Oh, the SIM swapping. Yeah.
Right. So talk about a little bit. Do you know how this works?
Yeah, that's tough still. So basically what they do is, like, it's a social engineering hack. And basically they'll call into like your mobile provider and have to convince them that they are you. And then they'll say that they want to port the phone number over to a different provider. So let's say you're on AT&T, and like they call into AT&T and they're like, okay, I want to port my phone number to T-Mobile, right? And then they've already got like an account set up on T-Mobile and they've got a SIM card, right? Once they have that phone number ported over to the new SIM card and then they have access to it, then they can get the SMS alerts that are associated with like your two-factor or these accounts or whatever. And then, like, yeah, that's it. Like, you know, you're done.
That's actually very, very scary. And I think in the article I read, within like 2 hours, he was locked out of everything. And it was like a cascading thing where he saw his like some SMS notification and then his email, suddenly he got like a notice that it was locked out and he couldn't log in after that. And I think that's what's scary, is that once they shut that down and you lose access to that, and like one by one, like the dominoes kind of start falling too. And it's actually probably not that hard to steal, like convince someone with all the footprints they have online now.
Well, that's just it too. I mean, there's another kind of high profile social engineering hack that happened a few years ago. This was a guy named Matt Honan, who at the time he was a writer at Wired, but I think now he's at BuzzFeed. But basically these guys, they did the same thing, but they called into Apple and they got Apple to like reset his Apple ID. And then they used that to just take over everything still, right? you know, so once they had that Apple ID, apparently like just the way that he had things set up, it was connected to, you know, everything else, right? So it was tough, like, cause they deleted like photos of his like kids and stuff, like off of like iCloud and or whatever, right? Like, you know, it was rough, but he wrote about how that happened in great detail. Actually, it was quite
interesting. Well, and also your Apple ID can disable other devices. Well,
that's right. I mean, that's why he's saying like it was happening like to him in real time. He's like, you know, looking at his iPad and all of a sudden it's like, what's happening, right? You know, and go to the laptop, uh-oh, like, you know, problems, right?
Yeah, like one thing is that we cannot fully avoid the in any system to be actual points of failure. That, I mean, wherever there's control, there is the risk of losing control. So it's kind of hard to mitigate these risks for someone to, I don't know, lose their email or someone getting their password and controlling things for an individual's identity. But it's quite another thing for someone to hack a big database of millions of identities. And that's kind of what's been going on for a while, since we have all these multiple silos around each user creating their own personas and replicating their data among different service providers. What we're doing is pushing it to the edges. In this case, it's the identity owners, the users. So still the owner, there must be some education, like the owner has to be careful about their means of control. There are manners of minimizing the risks, such as this two-factor authentication and all sorts of recovery mechanisms. But in the end, the user always have to be responsible of their data, and we cannot avoid that. One thing that it's quite interesting about all this, like using cryptography to prove identity, is the concept of selective disclosure. Also, more technically speaking, zero knowledge proofs. Without entering much detail, the essence of it is that you can prove to someone that some calculation was done and the calculation was correct without revealing the actual parameters of the calculation. So in the case of might want to prove, classic example, you want to prove you're over 21. So in the real world, you show your driver license. So there's all sorts of non-relevant information being disclosed in that case, such as your name and your actual age. Point is that with the proper means of selective disclosure of zero knowledge, you can prove to someone, like cryptographically, you can prove that you're over 21, for example, without even revealing your actual age. That's quite interesting because it allows a level of control that so far we haven't had in any identity mechanism view. And that's something that technologies such as blockchain and a proper cryptography can solve.
Yeah, we'll go into how that works later in a future episode because that's kind of very technical. But I think going back to the control aspect you talked about is that the more centralized control you have, the more attractive a target is to kind of either A, lose the data or get hacked. Because you look at like a crypto exchange that has what, 200 million, 500 million? Like the more it gets, the more attractive it is to actually hack. Because, and also like if you own the data yourself, well then, you know, you're going to hack what, 10,000 people one by one? That doesn't make any sense.
Another way to sort of focus on like the mitigation of these risks is around biometric identification as well too. And that's something that we'll talk a lot more about later on, but you know, just to give you one example about these guys that are calling in doing like the SIM swaps or like the one where they called into Apple there. A few things, I mean, you can have like approved phone numbers that you could call in from, but also for example, the bank that I guess I have accounts with or whatever, they have a thing now where you just call in and start talking and they do a voice recognition over the phone. And then, yeah, you're done. You're authenticated. So they're not doing like any of those like personal information questions or anything like that anymore. You just start talking and then like, yeah, you are authenticated. And so it goes, I guess it's taking like all of like the recordings or whatever of like all the times I phoned in and stuff and like plugging that into some kind of like, you know, AI mechanism. Yeah. So stuff like that is pretty interesting. So, and then we'll get into more biometric stuff like, you know, with the facial recognition and, you know,
that. Yeah. That'll kind of be dependent on how good that AI is at comparing to both of them too, right?
I've always wondered too, it's like, could you just like stick like a recording of someone's voice? But I think the other thing that sort of, and this is like more specifically around social engineering hacks, is that because the authentication is happening while you're on the line with like a customer service agent. So like if your voice like just like started changing or like it seemed like a bit dodgy, like, you know, there's also, you know, a human.
I talk lower. Yeah. I'll talk lower.
there's a human on the other end who can like sort of, you know, use, their judgment, I guess, you know, to see like, okay, this is a bit weird.
Yeah. Cause I saw an Adobe demo of like the new Audition, I think. And basically they had someone the presenter like read two sentences and then later he just like typed it and then it said in his voice. And I was like, whoa, that is so scary.
Yeah.
Adobe could do that with their AI now too. Because I guess if your AI could analyze a voice, it probably could reverse engineer it and like tech, right? So it's kind of scary, but
yeah, I guess the iris scan is one of the most reliable so far mechanism for biometric validation.
But you can't just put a picture of the eye, you know, like okay, I'll take a picture of the eye, print it out, like, you know.
What if someone can like genetically clone an eye too, and then that becomes scary?
Ooh,
yeah. That's like a whole nother world. Yeah. All right, cool. So let's move on to the next segment here. So let's talk about technology and freedom. This is something that we talked about internally before. I think, Carlos, we've talked about using technology for freedom the right way or the wrong way. So where do you want to start off with this?
One of the main goals of cryptography, for example, has been going on is to protect data, is to protect their users, protect things. There's this vibe of libertarianism, to name it in a certain way, that is technology being used for freedom. And I guess it's pretty a consensus already that things like cryptocurrency can work in favor of freedom for the users. So in these cases, some level of financial freedom and digital identity can work towards offering freedom to their users about their identity, their attributes, their data. But certainly when there is the desire to control one specific authority or party to control others, it becomes possible to use technology in the opposite direction. So some governments applying high level biometric recognition mechanisms, technologies to affect the behavior and the perception of their population. Yeah, that's pretty scary, all the things that can be done when technology is in the hands of someone. So I guess that's where the whole concept of decentralization comes, which is to mitigate the danger of having anyone too much control over, especially over others. Many interesting things are happening since the coming of this blockchain technology and many people talking about decentralization, which was not a common thing to hear about before. Because we were used to thinking of these authorities, big parties, establishing what we can do and what we cannot. So something still, I think, quite undervalued, such as cryptocurrency, allows you to do things that you couldn't do before. Quick example would be the very fact of owning, if you do it properly and you own your private keys and you manage your crypto, it's a common saying that you're your own bank. I was living in Venezuela. I didn't have a bank account that I could receive foreign currency. And Bitcoin allowed me to have anyone send me money, like if it were sending me an email. That changes like... It can be life-changing for someone. It was in my case that I could just work for a company overseas. So it's that putting control back to each individual is quite a powerful tool of the whole decentralization movement.
Yeah. Was that a restriction by the government on your bank to not receive overseas funds, or what was the cause of that?
Yeah, there are all sorts of restrictions in case of Venezuela for a while, financially and in other aspects, but financially, there's a currency exchange control, like the government dictates what's the exchange rate, which is quite an unreal exchange rate, not the real one people use. So in theory, I could have received US dollars, but the amount of money I would be losing is ridiculous. So it is just not feasible when there are these kind of restrictions. So using crypto was simple manner, legal, to just get my money and not be limited by that kind of thing, that kind of barrier.
Yeah, it's censorship proof, essentially. I remember when we met up in December, one of our colleagues in Brazil was saying if he wired money to himself in his own name, there would be like an extra tax on that. Like, that just blew my mind. That like, it's so insane. Yeah. I was like, because like in the US, you send money to yourself, you know, some $5 fees here and there, but like none of this, it was like a 3% tax or like 5%. I was like, that's crazy.
That's bizarre. That they do that. Yeah, all these different countries with their different sort of like financial regulations, and they're so scattered. I mean, like, you know, one country will have something that's, you know, pretty reasonable and fair, and then another country will have something that's just, you know, very like anti people, you know, almost, right? Like,
yeah, because we internally talked about the Ant Financial and the debt tracking app in China, right? Well, why don't you talk about this a little bit, Ben?
So this is, we're getting back into freedom, I guess, right? And sort of how governments are working to use technology to sort of implement their ideologies or the regulations or whatever that they want to do. Quick little bit of background. In China, they're implementing something called a social credit score. So this is different than just a credit score, which is only strictly, you know, financial and, you know, has to do with your ability to borrow money. The social credit score affects people's lives in many different ways. And so they use a carrot and a stick approach. So basically, if you do well and you have a high score, then you are able to take advantage of perks and little bonuses, right? And on the flip side, if you have a poor score, then you're going to have a tough time because you're going to start getting barred from like the ability to travel by airplane or the ability to travel by train. You won't be able to get a loan. You could be barred from working certain types of jobs. So it could get bad there. So, right. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're an individual who's you're kind of stuck, right? You know, like it's an extremely interesting concept, I think. I don't think it's going to end well, but
well, yeah, this doesn't sound like the level of control though that they're using technology.
Well, and now we get into the technology part of it, right? In one of the northern provinces, I believe in China, they're doing a pilot project where they've distributed this app, right? And the app is basically it's a map with pins on it. And the pins are identifying the location of people who owe money, right? So they have a debt maybe that's overdue or something. Maybe they didn't make their car payments or they're behind on their cell phone or something, right? So basically, the app is incentivizing people to go and spy on these other individuals who are in debt, observe sort of like what are they up to? Do they look like they're in a position to pay back their debt, right? And this is tricky because, you know, let's say I'm on that app. Let's say I'm behind on my car payment or something, right? And then I'm out having a frappuccino at Starbucks. And then somebody on this app goes and sees me and they're like, whoa, well, he's having Starbucks. Like, he's rich. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to report him, right? Is that really how you want to, you know, program your society to behave? So that's one question there, just sort of in a philosophical sense. But then again, like you're looking at this, you know, the technology being used for kind of like centralized malicious purposes, I guess, right? You know, and it goes way further from there. I mean, in China, you talk about the freedom or lack of freedom around sort of like the digital technologies, right? Every company that operates a user database in China has to give a backdoor to the Chinese government. It's like regulation. It is law. And like foreign companies have left China over this, you know, like Google. And then other ones have complied, like I believe Microsoft. probably Apple too at this point still.
Yeah, I think you look at like an app like WeChat. If you never used it before, like it's basically the app to use in China where you can talk to your friends. You can do voice chat. You can pay your utility bill. You can like, you know, order gym classes with your trainer. You can do like everything there. But the government has all this data. So basically, it's not that hard to build a credit score if they have your WeChat data, because pretty much everything is in there day in and day out too. Like you just go to a restaurant, you eat with friends, they can see where you ate, stuff like that, because you're splitting the bill on WeChat probably.
Oh, yeah.
Paying for your Metro card with that.
Talk about like your digital footprint, like we were before, about like what kind of a profile you're putting together. Like WeChat just like centralizes all that. Like you've got everything.
Like, you know, imagine Facebook, Google, Amazon, Netflix, Spotify, Uber, everything is in like one app. It's like in one app basically, and that's who you are. And it is who you are. I mean, it's convenient in some ways, but it's also, you know, scary because
that's how they get you, right? It's the you know, the convenience. And the other thing too is like if you go back to the carrot part of the equation too, right? I mean, if you're doing good, like, okay, I'm paying back all my bills on time, you know, never saying anything bad about the government, or, you know, like I'm not doing, you know, anything that would like lower my score, then your score goes up. And then all of a sudden it's like I'm getting discounts on hotels, I'm getting like, you know, discounts on this, discounts on that. I'm getting the ability to like access like, you know, financial services like through credit that wouldn't have been able to before, right? You know, there's the benefit side of it as well too, right? So some people are just like, okay, well, you know, I'm a person, let's say, you know, I'm a Chinese citizen, you know, like, a, you know, your regular average Joe there, right? You know, I've got like your normal job, you know, 1.5 kids or whatever. Maybe my game plan is just going to be like, okay, I'm going to try and do good on this social credit score thing, right? You know, and yeah, I'm just going to try and like go for the perks, right? You know, which is the opposite of, you know, the guy who just like, he had a string of bad luck, you know, or something, right? And all of a sudden now it's just like, you know, he's screwed. Like, he can't buy a bus ticket, you know, to go home.
You know? Also, like, is there a path to redemption from this too? Like, I mean, that's something we don't really have an answer to.
Yeah, in theory, at least. I mean, if you look at just like the credit score part of it, then yeah, you could do the things that would increase your credit score. So pay back your bills on time and, you know, do stuff like that. But yeah, it's tough. I mean, like, I think what will happen with the system is that you're going to see some people like who are already marginalized, you know, because they're already maybe in like, you know, financial difficulty or like, you know, having trouble, like, you know, just fucking integrating with society or whatever. Right. And now this is just going to magnify that problem, make it worse, you know, because it's going to start taking away their ability to do things. And when you start doing that too much to people, when you start taking too many things away, you get mad. And when people are mad and have nothing to lose, well, I mean, we've seen countless examples throughout history. So
yeah, we'll see. Every time there's a huge imbalance, it's like what, famine, hunger, violence, or something.
Yeah, it all goes hand in hand, right? So
yeah. But what's interesting is that they're basically gamifying the behavior they want in the citizens.
Yeah. The problem is that they're forced gamifying. That you cannot decide not to participate in the game, and that's the scary part. I mean, it's quite normal that authorities might want to incentivize desired behavior, good behavior, and disincentivize bad behavior. Governments have been doing that all along. But in this case, when you get technology in it, it's like the emerging behaviors that arise from that. Like, okay, you are incentivizing people to pay their stuff. That's cool. When you do that kind of thing, like you can, hey, let's incentivize people who spy on their neighbors. You're creating a behavior there. You're creating a culture. I cannot imagine like one way of violating freedom in worse way than to violate the freedom of the whole society and future generation, the freedom to develop their own culture. It's quite scary. It's very controlling, like in an extreme way. I don't know if I might being a little bit too optimistic, but the thing is that I think the world is going in a different direction, the rest of the world, the majority of places. I guess the side effect of this is that you have to isolate yourself in order to exert these levels of control over society. You get a like isolated universe out of your country for that to work, and that's not going to end well. That's not sustainable. It's not natural.
Well, that's already what's happened in China. I mean, they have their own internet, right? You know, I mean, they've kicked out all the different foreign services. They put a big firewall around, big control over what domains can be accessed and all that, right? And going back to sort of the way that this is happening in China, it's not a result of technology. The technology is just enabling it. This has been happening for, you know, decades and decades, right? Like, go back to like the 60s or so. They were teaching kids in school, you know, to spy on their parents and report back to them and stuff, right? So the whole like conditioning the population to spy on each other and report it back to the government, that's been going on for decades, right?
Yeah. But wanted to add, like, if you look at the spectrum of technology and freedom, on one side we have the super optimistic kind of like Liberland type where like everything's decentralized, you own your data, no one's getting hacked. But then on the other side you have kind of like China, or maybe worse, where, you know, it's enabling a lot of this bad stuff to happen. And it's like, where will each country fall between? Because one thing that kind of worries me about blockchain solutions is that, yes, you have an address that's protected cryptographically, but once you know someone owns this address and everything's on that address, you can kind of figure out what they've done, right?
Yeah, if I knew what your Ether address was that you were accepting payments to or something, right? Which probably isn't that hard if you have like a fulfillment address or something, then I can see like how many transactions, I can see what your sales figures are, or like, you know, how much money has gone in there. Unless you're, you know, being smart about it and generating a ton of like different addresses and, you know, aggregating them and stuff like that.
Yeah, right? Covering your footprints basically.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So like, let's say if you have like a blockchain sort of like payment processing for like an e-commerce shop, right? Like every customer gets a different address, it's that sort of thing. And then the funds from those get like forwarded somewhere else. But I mean, you could still trace it, you know, like, I mean, it's not a perfect way, you know, to cover it up, but you know, you can make it more difficult in any case, but ultimately the public nature of it does lend itself, you know, if you get clever and like, you know, you can put together a script that's, you know, going through all the different addresses and going back through the transactions.
So let's take a different angle then. So does DID cover this? If you have like umbrella DID and you have like 10 addresses under that, could you still cover your tracks that way, even though you own a DID, or is this technically not the way it works?
Well, I guess we would have to first like introduce for those who don't know what a DID is. It stands for decentralized identifier. So in summary, the idea is that blockchain is providing the scenario where you can prove to be in control of certain crypto funds. For example, you have a private key, so you are in control of something that is public. The idea is to take that concept to the world of identity, where an individual can prove that they own an identifier. That identifier is a DID. So since you can prove that you're in control of that identifier, then some blockchain-based technologies can provide the owner with the ability to associate that identifier with public information. Ideally, not personal information, but it might be, crypto addresses or other cryptographic keys. The anonymity, the privacy is one of the problems to solve, especially when dealing with public information. Everything in a blockchain is shared by multiple nodes in a network. So it's quite a challenge since we're dealing with public information. Like if I know someone's Bitcoin address, I can track their movements for life. It is important to be aware of what do we want to be public and what not.
Yeah, exactly. All right, cool. So let's close this out then with some news segments of the day. So this is kind of a bit of old news, but we talked about this a little bit internally. Project Atlas on Facebook, recently they were caught using VPN root access, paying teens $20 to $30 a month to get data. So basically, what is root access, Carlos?
Root means like the super user in Unix systems. So basically providing total control over your device to someone. If you give root access, that means they can have low level access to the devices, even hardware. Like it's total control.
Even like if your chat's encrypted, like on Telegram, it wouldn't work because it could bypass that, right? Yep, cool. So Facebook was caught spying on teens for this, and basically they were using a VPN to see, you know, someone using Snapchat, they're using WhatsApp, and they would either decide to kill or copy a certain application. So I think this is something interesting that came out, but which is funny because the same day this came out, they recorded like record earnings, and I think it kind of got swept under the rug
right,
the week after, and now no one's really talking about it. But it's scary that they would go to those means to do that. And you think about what you do on your phone every day, who you're messaging, like whether it's your mom, you know, your wife, your kids, all this, like everything, they have access to this, at least for a teenager too. So, but the counter argument I heard was that it's pretty normal to do market research. It's just, I think this level of access.
Yeah, they could do market research without having to do that. I mean, it's a shortcut, maybe.
Exactly. All right, so we'll leave it at that. Thanks for joining us today. We'll catch you guys in a couple weeks. Next episode, we're going to talk about some more digital identity topics. If you'd like the show, give us some feedback, ideas.selfie.org, and make sure to download the Selfkey Vault. It's a desktop Ethereum wallet that you can start building your digital ID in that we've all talked about today. And then we'll see you guys soon.
Thanks, Jerry.
See you guys. Thanks a lot. See you later.